Hey, how's it going? How you been? What's scrappin'?
Doing these class, motherfuckers.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Weekly Scraps, episode 71. Oh, my God. Now, I might have a little janky-looking mic. It's definitely not what I normally use. I think I got to turn the volume down because this shit looks like it's reading really, really loud. I think that's better. I'm still here in beautiful Las Vegas. I am not at the most fancy hotel, but I'm still at a hotel, motel, holiday, O-Y-O. Okay. So let's just get right into it, because there's not much of an update that I need to give besides I feel good. I think my range of motion is definitely coming along, and I mean, still a little janky going downwards, flexing the wrist, but going backwards, I'm getting a lot more active mobility, and I think the rest of this week should really, really start to make things take off a little bit more. So I'm very positive and optimistic about that. And I do think I could potentially be back in May. So right now I'm scheduling myself to be back in May. I'm talking with the matchmakers, talking with my management at Ballinger Group, and let's see what happens. And obviously I got to see how this last remaining week plays out and then go back home and finish up my therapy as much as I can, just to keep things constantly oiled up and keep everything moving. So UFC 248, good, bad, ugly, a couple things we need to talk about. I'm going to just go right into the main stuff. We're going to work our way backwards this time. So we're going to start with the main event. So overall, the card was very good. Obviously, the main event was very, very lackluster and left people wanting more and left people confused and left people contemplating whether or not they should eat that last barbecue chicken. No, that's not it, but very random. But what I'm saying is it was a very random acts of emotion in that fight, very random type of fight, something I don't think any of us predicted was going to happen. But if we do look at history, time and time again, we have seen that fights with big rivalries or that are very, very well played up tend to be a dud. Let's call it what it is. It really does tend to be a dud. I mean, we look at John Jones versus Rashad Evans. We look at Rashad Evans versus Rampage Jackson. I mean, we had TJ Dillashaw versus Cody Garbrandt, both of them. Those were good rivalries. So not all of them, but history has showed us that time and time again, if fights have a lot of animosity or one guy talks up the fight tremendously or the UFC overly hypes up a fight, sometimes I think the fighters buy into the hype of their opponents and we do not fight up to our abilities, or we play it a little more safe than we typically would, if that's making any type of sense whatsoever. So I look at a fight like Israel Adesanya versus Yoel Romero, a lot of hype. Now, right off the gate, let me let you guys know where I stand. Now, people keep taking this quote out of context because I didn't put the quotations, but it's a saying that has been said for years. It's like me saying that the sky is green. The sky's not fucking green, you moron. The sky's goddamn blue. You know, whether you want to say, well, it's a reflection off the ocean and the ocean is really green, and shut the fuck up. What I see with my receptors and what the majority of us people see is a blue sky. So if I just write that, that doesn't mean I necessarily believe it. But people automatically just assume, like, you just believe everything because you wrote something. That doesn't mean, because I made a statement, and it's not like so I'm trying to clarify this the best way I can. I'm not making a statement, and I forgot to use quotations. With that being said, is I do not agree with the quote that you have to beat the champ to be the champ. I do understand what the quote is saying and alluding to, meaning that if the fight is really close, the champ should get the nod. And I tend to agree with that. If The stats do not support, and I mean round by round stats, not a totality of the fight. Because you could have a dud of a first round, a dud of a second round, and third round pick the guy apart and look like a fucking world beater. That doesn't mean you won the fight. You lost rounds one and two. Each fight, each round is, the score, the fights are scored by a round-to-round basis, almost as if they are individual fights. It's like, yo, I'm going to see you after school. You fight. Yo, I'm going to see you in the lunchroom. Then you fight. And, yo, I'm going to see you down by the park at the party or something. It's a different round. It's a different fight. That's kind of how these fights are scored. And you have to look at them at individual basis. If it was the Pride rules, they would be scored as a totality, as a whole. Who ended the fight stronger? Who should have won the fight? Excuse me. But as we can see, that is not the case here. It's round by round. So where I stand is, watching the fights, I had Romero for rounds 1, 2, and 5. Yes, Izzy did a lot of damage with the leg kicks. And I'm going to say those leg kicks start to really add up in round, or should I say those, the numbers of the leg kicks start to really go up when in rounds 4 and 5 and some of round 3. But those are the two rounds that I think Izzy won, rounds 3 and 4. But let's look at the situation here. The UFC built up Yoel Romero as this big, scary guy. Everyone on social media builds up Yoel Romero as this big, scary guy. We know if he catches you in a blink of an eye, you could be put out. Lying on your back, questioning yourself, or the ref, I should say, asking what happened. You know, so that's the way I like to look at that. And then you look at the way the UFC has built up Izzy as a spectacular counterfighter. So you have yin and yang. Yoel Romero can catch you coming in or catch you relaxing. Izzy, Israel Adesanya, can catch you coming in on the back foot, as we saw with Robert Whittaker. You saw him when he's picking up speed against a guy like Kelvin Gastelum. You saw him what he did to Derek Brunson when Derek Brunson rushes in. You know, so we have to respect the dangers of both opponents. I don't expect Yoel Romero to just say, yo, I'm going to push the fight and come at you like a madman and run in and risk getting countered and put to sleep like, put down like Robert Whittaker was. I'm not going to take that risk. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, this is the last title fight, potentially biggest fight of your life, career-defining moment because of what's at stake and who you potentially can beat and take out. So with all that being said, I do not fault Yoel Romero for fighting the way he did. As a fan, I am disgusted in the way he fought. Because at the end of the day, he could have chosen to fight differently, but he didn't. He fought safer. Am I mad at him as a fighter looking in, knowing what the risks are and calculating everything? No, I don't think Yoel Romero did anything particularly wrong. It wasn't an exciting fight. There are plenty of fights that are not exciting. It's just the nature of the beast. When you have two high-level guys like that, one guy makes one critical error and that fight goes the other way for the other guy or other female. We look at Israel Adesanya versus Robert Whittaker. Whittaker thought the key was following up with like Kelvin Gastelum did, pushing forward when he can and trying to split and blitz Adesanya and catching him off guard. We all saw what happened. Izzy is sharp, and although Izzy beat him by a couple of inches, maybe an inch, in the connecting on Robert Whittaker before Whittaker connected on him, that's the difference. That's the type of opponent, high caliber skill that you're dealing with when you walk into that octagon against a guy like Israel Adesanya. Yoel Romero is a competitor, very smart guy. I think he understood the risk involved in blitzing and running forward. He was going to fight in spurts. And let's be real here. Go back and look at Romero's last few fights. That's how he fights. He fights in spurts. He does not walk you down, making you feel like he's looking to trade or going to pressure you all the time. He's just that guy who's like C4, boom, blink of an eye, he's going to catch you and explode. And hopefully that connection is in devastating fashion and puts your lights out. That's the type of fighter that Yoel Romero truly is. So I don't fault him. I felt that fight could have gone that way in terms of Yoel Romero being the stationary guy. Remember, I said I was disgusted with the performance because I'm just like, yo, what the fuck am I? What are we doing? This, you get a title shot coming off of two losses, and this is what we get. I got another guy in front of me who's about to get two losses, who has two losses in a row, and two in his last four fights, his last six fights, 2-4 in his last six fights, getting a title shot. And I'm like, see what happens with these guys who are 0-2? I'm not saying that's the case, because you're 0-2, that's what, how you're going to fight, but it's relevant. Obviously, every fight's different. Every person is different in the way that they attack a situation. But it just jogged my memory during the fight, watching it live. I'm like, man, this could potentially be good or bad. And watching it was not good. as I said in my previous breakdown, go back and listen. In my last episode, I said Adesanya would come out, he would be probing. What did Adesanya say? He was like, I was trying to probe him, or I was trying to land a spinning, a flying knee. I had three different ways I was looking to end that fight, and none of those happened. And again, it's because of the style of Yoel Romero. He is a beast. He is a physical specimen. And I don't care what anybody says. None of you motherfuckers are going in there, guns blazing, trying to take out Yoel Romero in devastating fashion, because you know what the consequences are. No one's trying to do that against Paulo Costa either. You know what the consequences are. Those guys are people who just need to touch you once, and they're going to put you on your ass or put your lights out. Simple, point blank, period. I thought Adesanya did a great job with chopping down the legs. I wish he might have done that a little earlier. I think round one, there were only about six strikes landed. I want to say Romero landed about four of those six strikes landed. I know Adesanya attempted more, but landed less in that first round, where Yoel Romero standing there like a statue, and then he does the Ali shuffle with his feet. I'm like, Jesus Christ, what is going on? But as you're watching, you could feel the intensity in the air, because you know there is a split second away from Adesanya being caught, or Yoel Romero running in and getting caught. That's what I felt while watching that. So I get it. I get both sides of the party. But at the end of the day, guess who was left holding the bag? The fans. The fans. And sometimes it goes like that. So I'm not upset about it. I just don't think people singing the praise of Adesanya and not singing the praise of Yoel Romero. Romero stayed disciplined. Adesanya stayed disciplined to the game plan. Round five, Yoel Romero was trying to make a statement like, yo, come, let's fight. Let's stay in the middle, let's fight. But you can't make a guy fight your fight. And this is why it's called having good ringmanship and footwork, because once you start to slide out of the way, you get a little frustrated because you can't seem to get your hands or your reins and hitting your opponent. And that's how the fights sometimes go. So that's what I feel about that fight. I don't think there was a real winner. I don't think there's any losers besides the crowd, the fans across the millions of world, and the millions of people across the world. And I did see a meme that Adesanya commented on, and he said, greatest middleweight fight of all time, Adesanya versus Kelvin Gastelum title fight, and greatest, most boring middleweight title fight, Adesanya versus Romero. I thought that was hysterical, and it shows that Izzy has a sense of humor, as always, as I think we all know, and I think he can rationalize that fight was not exciting whatsoever. The build-up was exciting. The walkouts were exciting, but the fight itself, after coming off of the co-main event that we came off of, that was not exciting. So here we are, and we're going to see what's going to happen next with these guys. Next up, we have Zhang Weili, or Weili Zhang. Oh, my God. This is so fucked up, because I'm seeing it spelled different ways. Which one is the first name? Weili Zhang is what I'm going to say. Defeats Joanna Jędrzejczyk, split decision. In my personal opinion, I thought the decision should have gone the either way. But to be fair, the fight was extremely close. I didn't think it was a robbery, but I did think that Joanna did enough offensively to get the nod. So I was kind of, I don't want to say confused, but I told myself I need to go back and watch that fight, as well as I need to go back and watch the Adesanya fight. I haven't had a chance yet. I was in LA the other day on Sunday night for all of 20 hours. I came right back to Vegas to finish up PT. I had to go see my friend. But back to this, man, I thought both females looked phenomenal. They set a level of precedent for what title fights should look like in the females division, and they kind of spoiled us. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward for these guys. I do think a rematch should be warranted. I'm not sure if there's another immediate title challenger right now with a big enough name that the UFC could push. I mean, I'm sure you could just do the right thing and give it to the next number one contender, of course. But after a performance like that, I think you let these girls heal up and let them run it back, and we see what happens. Because it was that close, and I do think it should have gone the other way. But again, it wasn't a robbery by any means. I can see why I went to Weili Zhang, and I can see why I had a score for Joanna Jędrzejczyk. And I hope that's not my bias kicking in for Joanna, but obviously they're both super cool people. I got to meet Weili at the UFC PI Center, and after her fight, I got to see her and meet her. And I didn't want to be like a groupie, like, oh, you know, I had it for Joanna, but I'm gonna take it. You know, that stuff is kind of weird to me. And I feel people do that a lot. I would have to like tell her like I did score it for Joanna, but I can see why you want. You know, and I'm not looking to do all that. You just won the fight. I'm not looking to rain on anybody's parade. I want you to be able to enjoy your moment. But it is what it is. I'm just going to say I think Joanna did enough. But it was a very back and forth affair. I would have to go back and figure out which rounds I scored for Joanna. I remembered it a little bit better when it was Saturday night. But fun fight. Now, I saw Weili Zhang, Weili being carried over by a corner to the corner, by a cornerman to the corner. I thought that was a little weird. I don't know what that was about. I don't know if that was like a thing that they normally do for all their fighters, or was it just something that they do personally. But I don't know what to make of it. Someone was asking me if that's illegal. I don't think it's illegal. I think it's just a little odd. I think if I saw my opponents being carried to the corner, I'm going to look over and be like, huh, maybe they're hurt, maybe they're tired, but I have no idea. So there's not much I can really say about that, but there's so much to unpack in that fight, man. I thought Joanna was landing beautiful combinations, sliding in and out. I thought Weili, like I said, had the heavier shots, landed with more power. Joanna was finishing a lot of combinations and ending with the leg kick, which I thought was beautiful kickboxing. A couple of takedown attempts, Joanna was able to stop him or get back up. Weili Zhang did a good job of making some adjustments and then started to find her rhythm and start to land more. I forget which round that was in. I want to say it was rounds three and starting to really pick away. But then Joanna would come back and rally back with her own striking combinations. That's why it was super hard to score. It was a fun fight no matter what. Probably the greatest female fight in the strawweight division and probably arguably of all time. You know, it had everything that you needed. Drama. It had back and forth. It had Joanna getting hurt. And looked like Weili Zhang was going to pick up on that and pick up on that momentum and follow up and potentially get Joanna out of there. And Joanna was able to recover by getting on her bike. It had everything a fight fan could ask for. And was even more amazing, I think it was a couple of days or a day before International Women's Day. So what better way to celebrate that by two powerful women coming out there and putting on a performance like that of a lifetime. That's what I found super spectacular. And those women deserve to take a bow after that. Obviously, we saw the aftermath of Joanna Jędrzejczyk's head. Ooh. The memes that were out there were brutal, but man, she did look like all those things that people were showing. I'm like, yeah, this is crazy. And I think it was potentially a headbutt that started the swelling. I could be wrong, but with those type of things, I don't really know what causes a hematoma besides obviously getting hit, but like a specific style of getting hit or a specific pressure point of getting hit or maybe a way that you rehydrate causes more inflammation. I have no idea. We saw Mark Hominick versus Jose Aldo back when they fought in the UFC fight. I think it was one of the first ones for a title shot when the 45 and 35 pound divisions were being introduced to the UFC and 125 as well. So I don't know. It was not, it was pretty gnarly looking. And I heard the next day was even worse. I heard the eyes were, the swelling was starting to come down to her eyes. And she might have to try to get that drain. It might be the best possible way she could get the swelling reduced and the pressure from off of her eyes and stuff like that. So it's a tough sport. I love the sport so much, but injuries like that are what deter people from ever wanting to fight. And deter people from ever making a return back to the octagon. I don't think Joanna's done yet. I think she still has a little bit more in the tank. She is still the most winningest fighter in all of UFC championship history for the female strawweight division. So I'm very interested to see what is going to be, what is going to happen for her next. So we'll see. Now, we're going to slide over to the next fight. Beneil Dariush versus Jakar Klaus. Oh, my goodness. Round two. 1 minute left on the clock. Jakar Klaus clips Beneil Dariush. After round one, where Dariush is dominating on Klaus's back the entire time, backpacking him. I thought his legs might be a little fatigued going into the second round, and Jakar was going to be able to pick him apart with him being a little bit more of a stationary target, but that was not the case. But Klaus did clip him, hurt him, and it looked like he was about to get him out of there. He not rushed in, but he moved in for the kill, and somehow, some way, Dariush was able to recover and find a perfect placement for one of his crosses and one of his hooks. And he sent Jakar backwards, starting to retreat on his own accord. And eventually, he was able to land a kill shot near the cage that put Dariush, that put Jakar Klaus down. And the way he fell was in slow motion. So when he fell, instantly, we all knew who were sitting there cage side that he was not going to be able to recover like he did from the first big shot that he ate. And we knew that was the beginning of the end. And once he hit the canvas, Dariush knew he was done. The ref did the right thing, jumping in at the right time and not allowing Jakar to take any more damage. And the good thing I will say about, yes, you were knocked out, but the good thing was Mr. Klaus's head did not fall and crash against the canvas, which I was happy to see. And obviously, when you have stuff like that happens, it makes for bigger damage down the road. And the canvas is not forgiving whatsoever. So good thing he hit the cage and was able to fall, I believe, on all fours or on his forearms sideways, but not with his head slamming or the back of his head slamming against the canvas. Those always suck. Suck to see it. So far, it hasn't happened to me. Thank God. Thank God. Next fight, Neil Magny versus Li Jingliang, the Leech. Unanimous decision, 30-27 across the board. I have not seen Magny look any better than that against higher tier competition. It looked like he's finally starting to put it together against those higher level guys. And I'm it's tough to say that for a guy like the Leech because we do not know if he has the goods and the mental capacity to be the high-level guy. Well, you look at Neil Magny, he is a high-level guy or a guy who's been around with a little bit more clout, a little bit more name value, Ultimate Fighter, coming back, being one of the most improved fighters, I think, one of the most winningest fighters at the welterweight division. I think he has a 15 or 16 wins so far in that division. You look at a guy like that and look at a guy like the Leech, he's just still finding his stride in the UFC. I think he's got 4 or 5 wins in the division now. But when you fight a guy like Neil Magny, I thought Jingliang was going to show that he is ready for that upper echelon of the division. But Magny was able to turn him back. And again, he looked phenomenal the way he was able to do it. Shut him down from beginning to end. And Jing Liang could not find his rhythm, and Magny's grappling also looked like it improved a ton. So I'm excited to see what's next for Magny after coming off that long layoff from that suspension that he had. I'm not exactly sure what he was suspended for, but I believe there was a couple guys that were suspended for the same thing. I'm just excited to see what he's going to turn into next and see if he can continue to build off of that momentum. Next up, Alex Oliveira, Big Smacks Griffin, split decision, very close fight, back and forth. I was not sure which way it was going to go. Oliveira won round one. I do think Max won round three. And round two for me was a toss-up, if I'm remembering this fight correctly. It was a little, like I said, it was back and forth. I wasn't sure who was going to get the nod. And both guys came out to fight. We saw Max Griffin rock a huge cut in the middle of his eyebrows, and was still able to battle forward and push forward and still try to push to get the win and try his best to get the finish. But unfortunately, it came up short. Max is a really good dude. I don't know Oliveira, never met him, but seems like a good dude himself. Came over, I believe took the feather out of his hat and put it into Cowboy Cerrone's hat as well. So again, good fight, good competitive scrap, and I wasn't sure who was going to get the nod. And, you know, if it went the other way, couldn't have been upset with that either way. Next up, we have the return of Sean O'Malley. O'Malley. Oh, Sean O'Malley. O'Malley. If you guys don't know where that's from, you guys see Snoop Dogg on the Dana White Contender Series when he made his debut. And Uriah Faber was on there with him as well. It was the most hysterical thing from Snoop Dogg that I've ever seen. But he knocks out TKO's Jose Quiñones. Head kick, then into follow-up with punches, and he looks sharp. Front kick right into a spinning back kick. Very composed, threw a chopping leg kick. Quiñones came back with a 1-2, came up short on the two. Looked like it was glancing, might have just touched his chest or his neck. So it was a very short fight. How long was this? About 2 minutes and 2 seconds left in the first round. But O'Malley showed some good poise when Teco was able to rush in and look like he closed the distance. O'Malley throws a right hand, cuffs him over. He's a covers. Throws a right hand, chucks him over to the side. Teco tries to get up. As he's getting up, O'Malley faints hard, like he's about to throw something big. Teco bites ridiculously hard, covers up, shells, and O'Malley gets the chance to pinpoint where he wants to land a perfect head kick while a guy is using one hand to block the kick. The kick wraps around, connects. So he's covering in a shell. The kick comes around, cracks him, and he follows up with a punch. And Teco falls down to his back. It almost looks like he pulls guard. I would consider that pulling guard. Looked like he was trying to avoid damage and recover. And O'Malley did not let off one bit. Next up, I saw O'Malley in the back room, and I actually told him congratulations on his return. That was a great fight. He looked really, really good, really solid all the way around. I mean, obviously, we didn't see any ground game or any groundwork, but he looked solid all the way around, good footwork, good ring generalship. And at the end of the day, I know the UFC's posted him. They're back on the O'Malley train, and I know Merab's been calling for this fight for the longest. So hopefully, the UFC can match these young guys up and give Merab an opportunity and give O'Malley an opportunity to show that he can handle a high-level grappler, wrestler, I should say. Merab's not the greatest jiu-jitsu guy, but when it comes to certain positions, I will say he is a nightmare because of his sambo background and his judo background. So, like I said, not the most traditional BJJ guy, but when he gets to certain positions, he is a motherfucker to deal with. And I mean that in a good way. So, if he can get O'Malley down, which I do think he will if he cuts him off, and obviously he would have us to work with to help him prepare, I can mimic anybody and give him those looks. Obviously, I'm not going to be throwing stuff with reckless abandon like an actual fist fight would be, where it's not reckless abandon. It's where the guy will be throwing with real bad intentions. I'm going to be throwing to give him looks so that he can try to see everything in the real-time speed and get the timing down for a guy like O'Malley. But sky's the limit for that guy. And that just lets you know how deep this division is. O'Malley's not ranked. Marab's not ranked. TJ's not ranked. Dominic Cruz isn't ranked. And Thomas Almeida, who I saw see at the PI Center time and time again, isn't ranked either. So it lets you know that this division is not one to play around with. So I'm excited to see how things play out for both these guys and their careers. Next up, we have Mark Madsen versus Austin Hubbard. Great fight, 29-28 across the board. Mark Madsen's displaying that beautiful Greco wrestling. I believe he was a silver medalist, but going out there and showing why the hype is real. But Austin Hubbard was able to rally back in that third round and start to really find some home for his strikes and his combination. And it's not a fight you can be mad about. The way he finished that fight was perfect. It let everybody know that he can wrestle with the best. He was able to get up a couple of times, and a lot of times he was being controlled. But I mean, a guy like Mark Madsen, once he gets his hands locked, good luck trying to pry that grip open. It's almost impossible. So I think Hubbard did some good work in there, obviously getting souped with something that he could have definitely planned for. So he should have expected that that was going to happen, the belly to back suplex where he picked him up and took him over his head and over into the other direction, slammed him down. But to his accord, he was able to get right back up to his feet, not escape, but he got back up to his feet. I'm interested to see what's next for Madsen and what's next for Hubbard. Hubbard is managed by Balanji as well. And Madsen, I'm not sure who he's partnered with right now, but the hype is real. I think he's going to need to work on the cardio a bit. And I think little by little, take those baby steps and work on his striking the same way I did, being a big time wrestler and coming in and starting to learn how to use those hands. And obviously those kicks, I've always been a bigger kicker. I'm still going to be a big kicker. And I think that's going to help Madsen develop at a pretty good rate. We just have to see what his ceiling is for that rate of striking. And at the end of the day, you never want to abandon what got you to the show, which is his grappling. Next up, Rodolfo Vieira versus Sabarbek Safarov. Safarov comes out and clips him early with a big front kick to the face. Cuts Vieira early. Eyes shuts almost immediately. Shoots a takedown. Gets it. But how you say, Safarov was able to use that overhand, that wizard is what we call it, whip him over and get back to his feet. They break in the action. And once again, Vieira darts in on a double leg, but this time he gets him down to the cage, takes him down. And you can see the beautiful transitions as he tries to get to the back, as Safarov tries to get his back to the cage to stand up. He gets to all fours. But the moment he does that, Vieira gets his hooks in. Beautiful jiu-jitsu, beautiful transitions. And Safarov was holding the glove. The ref stopped the action, kept them in the same position and reset them, took his gloves, hands out the gloves. And once he took his hands, his fingers out of the gloves, he reset that position. And Vieira was able to continue his ways and transition to the back. He flattened him out a little bit, threw a couple strikes. Safarov was able to not shrimp out, but he tried to adjust. And as he was losing the back mount, he went to full mount. He lost the back to full mount. He transitioned into full-on back control. He had the back control with the hooks in. Then he transitioned to the full-on mount. And from there, Safarov was holding on, double underhooks. And Vieira controlled the head. And then he controls the head with his left hand, and then he switches, transitions with the right, almost like he scoops his head up and gets a deeper bite with the underhook over the overhook, I guess, of his head, and gets his fingers into the armpit of Safarov, his right fingers into the armpit, takes his left hand, pries inside of that lock of Safarov, and boom, punches it in right away and starts walking the fingers up immediately. Head and arm choke, beautiful transition, and gets a tap almost immediately. Great win for Vieira, who's now 7-0. Now we have Gerald Mershaw versus Deron Wynn. Good fight. Eventually, Mershaw is able to hurt Deron Wynn, follows up, goes to retreat, but eventually he's able to take him down, Mershaw, and sink in a rear naked choke, which was on the chin. Wasn't much in terms of defense that Wynn was doing to defend it, and he just crushed the chin and eventually got it under the neck, and that was enough for Deron Wynn to tap. That first round was really close. back and forth. I would say probably Deron Wynn won that one, but Mershad was able to stay the course, and I think his size advantage in terms of his height and probably the weight too played a big factor. Deron Wynn is a tough dude, but he's also a smaller guy for the weight class. I do think he's about 5'6". They said I'm 5'7", and I'm not fighting at 145 pounds. I'm fighting at 135. Deron Wynn cannot make 135. But he could potentially get down to 170, but it will be a lifestyle change and a huge, huge commitment. Maybe 185 is the weight class he needs to be in. And obviously he struggled with the weight. I think he did miss the weight, but I think maybe if he put on a little bit more muscle, or maybe it's just a technique. But at the end of the day, he's going to be one of those guys who's going to be a powerhouse. And you know what you're getting when you fight a guy like Deron Wynn. He can touch you up and he's got good hands. But for the most part, you got to stay out of trouble from that power. But if you can stay away from that, I think he's going to struggle with those guys who are 6 feet tall, 6'1", 6'2", which is going to make things quite a bit of a challenge for him. But I think he can find his way and figure out how to make his size, because he's got the power, like I said, and he's got the wrestling. If he can figure out for his size how to get inside and make these guys pay for overcommitting on a strike, and he can slip and rip, he could be a very, very scary, scary fighter. Next up, Giga Chikadze versus Jamal Emmers, split decision. I wasn't sure who was going to get this win. Round one, Giga all day. Second round, it was Giga until he got taken down. But then hit a beautiful oompa reversal and ended up in the guard of Emmers, but then got back to the feet. Not much strikes were landed from both guys after that. I would say Giga landed more, but Emmers probably landed the harder strikes. So it was tough to say who won that second round. But like I said, it was a close fight. Nobody ran away with that decision. In the third round, I think you definitely give it to Emmers. So it was a really close fight back and forth. And I think Giga is starting to show glimpses and shades of his grappling getting better. He came in as a kickboxer, and as a MMA fighter, I think he's doing pretty well right now. 2-0, beating Brandon Davis and then beating a guy like Jamal Emmers. And Brandon Davis was a guy who had some good name value, getting down to 35 for a couple fights, coming back up to 45. Going three rounds with Zabit. Well, 2.5, almost got to the end of the third round until he got submitted with the So You Have Stretch, the one that I hit on Cody Stamen. And last but not least, Danai Baccarell knocks out Guido Canetti. Beautiful, slips off the center line, southpaw orthodox stance, lands a hook, looks like it's a straight punch, but then turns it into a hook at the very end, clips him, puts him down, and then follows up with the strikes and gets him out of there. I got my eye on a guy like him. And Canetti, even though I do think he's very, very undersized at the bantamweight division, I think he did. It's hard to even say that. I mean, it's a fist fight. So you're going to throw it back. You're supposed to get hit. So it's hard to say he did well. But, you know, he tried his best to offer some offense that he could. I just think he's in the wrong division. So last but not least, this weekend we have Kevin Lee versus Oliveira. That's going to be a big fight. A couple of news in our What's Scrapping segment. So what's scrapping? We see Ortega slaps multi-platinum record recording artist Jay Park for translating to Takeo Mizugazaki. The Korean Zombie, Takeo Mizugaki. Oh my God, the Korean Zombie on Ariel Helwani's show. So supposedly in Korea, Ortega and Zombie met up and they apologized for what was being said, because he said that wasn't him, it was his promoter promoting it. And then the Ariel Helwani interview, Jay Park saying that Zombie pulled out of the fight and was dodging the fight or some shit like that. So Ortega felt the need to say, you know, I'm going to G-check you and I'm going to slap the shit out of you when I see you. And unfortunately, he did that. And he did that right in front of me, almost knocked my beer over. I was trying to stop him to pick my beer up. And as he's trying to get through, I'm trying to pick up my shit. I pick it up. He goes by. He goes up to Jay. I'm not sure what the fuck's going on. Next thing you know, I turn over. I look to my right. I look left. I look back to my right, because there's a fight going on. And all you see is whap. And I'm like, wow. And then he's, you know, like he said, I told you I was going to slap you like a bitch when I see you. I was like, damn, that just really happened, like literally right in front of me. Angela Hill's boyfriend is there. He breaks it up. He's wearing a referee button-up shirt. It's the most funny-looking thing. And then he gets in between a fight. So it was actually kind of funny. I thought it was kind of ironic how that happened. What else do we have? Broken jaw sidelines. Madsen. Wow. I didn't know. Madsen broke his jaw. Bellator UFC event still on amid virus outbreak. Singer told the cops UFC Ortega slapped him. I heard he's pressing charges. And Jones versus Gustafsson won to enter UFC Hall of Fame. And rep McGregor must face Gaethje before title shot. We'll see. And if he could beat a Justin Gaethje, I will say he might have earned a rematch with Khabib, because I think Gaethje's the next guy. And if he could beat a guy like that, then why not? I'm super interested for this fight coming up with Kevin Lee and Oliveira, though. I'm going to try to do another breakdown for that. Probably less than likely to happen, but I'm going to see what I can do, because I be mad busy, son. Let me actually just see who's on that card. March. Kevin Lee versus Oliveira. That is a huge fight, man. I'm just, what's today's date? Let me find my calendar. My calendar, the 14th. So March 14th. And then Tyron Woodley versus Leon Edwards is coming up soon. Man, there's a lot of good scraps coming. So on the prelim card for UFC Brasilia, we have a couple of marquee fights. Let's take a look. I guess the Shoeface fight against Makhmud Muradov was canceled. My girlfriend just texted me. Flyweight Bruno Silva is taking on David Duroc. That guy actually talked shit a couple of times to me about Henry Cejudo. So let's see if Karma will play him a bitch two times in a row now. We'll see. Women's bantamweight bout, Veronica Macedo versus Bea Malecki. I don't know who that is. Ronnie Yaya versus Enrique Barzola at bantamweight. Ilazu Zaleski dos Santos. I don't know if that guy hasn't fought since the last fight. I don't know. I haven't seen him in a while. Versus Alexi Kunchenko. Ronda Marcos versus Amanda Ribas. Juicier Fominga versus Brandon Moreno. That is going to be a fun fight right there. Brandon has been here at the PI Center all of last week, and I got to see him work out. He's looking good, looking sharp. Now, the main card, Francisco Trinaldo versus John Medeksi. Johnny Walker makes his return versus Nikita Krylov. Renato Moicano makes his return against Demir Hadzovic. And the co-main event, Damian Maia versus Gilbert Burns. That's a good fight. And Kevin Lee versus Charles Oliveira. A lot of good fights, man, especially the one with Kevin Lee and Oliveira. Oliveira is a submission specialist, taking on Kevin Lee, who is a grappling specialist, but starting to find his stride with the hands and obviously with the kicks. He seems to be a much better kicker than he is a puncher. I think his punches seem to be a little slow and telegraphed, but he did look sharp with the jab in his last fight against Gregor Gillespie, taking his time, low boxer stance, not allowing Gregor to get even anywhere near his legs whatsoever, keeping him at bay with just utilizing that jab. Stows over, slips Gregor's jab with the right hand, and steps in, walks in that switch kick. Boom. Floors Kevin Gregor Gillespie and gets a first round knockout. Charles Oliveira, DuBronx, very good with pressure. Throws up submissions after submission. I'm going to say Kevin Lee's going to have to weather an early storm from Charles Oliveira, but I can also see Kevin Lee trying to be the bully and push Oliveira back, because we all know when Oliveira is pressured and you attack the body and you attack him, he tends to cover up and he tends to what we call cheese doodle. We call that cheese doodling, where you curl up and you fold. So we've seen Frankie Edgar do it to him, Cub Swanson, but that seemed like the Oliveira of past, the Oliveira of new. Dad Oliveira seems to be a brand new reinvigorated man, and it's going to be super exciting to see how he shows up and how he decides to approach this fight. Can he utilize those elbows and knees? Will he go for the takedown against Kevin Lee, try to get Kevin Lee's back, or will Kevin Lee try to be the first guy to go out there, take him down right away? Got to be careful with those stepping knees and those elbows from DuBronx, and if he can get him down, we know Kevin Lee has beautiful back takes, and his rear naked choke finishes are no joke when he gets you down. Figure fours your body, and he arches as he's trying to decapitate your head from your body. Damian Maia, obviously enough said with that, taking on Gilbert Burns, who's also a black belt. There's black belts, and then there are black belts. So I'm excited to see if Burns can offer any type of way of resistance in the jiu-jitsu department, or will he just decide to opt to keep it standing, tire Maia out, and then look to probably take the fight or be okay with taking the fight to the ground? This is only three rounds, so Damian Maia, typically in three rounds, he is a beast, he is a savage, so I'm looking forward to see if Maia still got the juice, or is Father Time really, really catching up to him and saying, you know what, maybe it might be time to hang it up. He never got the chance to wear the UFC gold, and I know he's a super specialist, man. We saw what he did to Ben Askren. Can he do the same to Gilbert Burns? And I'm never one to count Damian Maia out. His jiu-jitsu is what it is. His offensive striking has gotten better and competent and complements his grappling. And I will say, if he gets Gilbert down early, we saw that Ben Askren had good jiu-jitsu, but Maia is just another level, and he choked Ben Askren out with one hand. So Gilbert better make sure he's done his homework, and I hope he's going to have enough game plan to keep the fight standing and watch out for those body locks of Damian Maia, because we know Gilbert used to fight at 55. He's coming up to 170. So he's not a natural, but he's not the biggest guy at 170, but he's still a big boy for 155. So that's going to be the difference, in my opinion. I'm not going to break down this entire main card. I'm about to get ready to head to the UFC PI Center. Another fight that interests me, I'm going to say this is my scrap of the week that I'm spotlighting. I do think it's going to be Johnny Walker versus Nikita Krylov. I'm looking forward to this one mainly because of the way Johnny Walker lost his last fight. I think Nikita Krylov is a super tough out. And will Johnny Walker be able to bounce back and get himself into the win column and in a big way? Or will he be a little gun shy coming off of the loss to Corey Anderson and trying to get himself back into the title talks and maybe people sing his praise again to potentially be a title challenger? But in order to do that, he needs to be a guy like Nikita Krylov, who is super well-rounded, good everywhere on the ground, competent striking. And Johnny Walker seems to be more of the explosive type. We haven't seen much technical striking from him yet in terms of like a technical boxing, like utilizing a jab, utilizing a 1-2, low kicks, combination with chopping up top, chop, and then chopping down low with the kicks. Or is he just going to look to explode again and be the madman that we're used to seeing and trying to just catch Nikita Krylov coming in and put him out in spectacular fashion like he has done a lot of his opponents in the past? So that is my scrap of the week. So stay tuned to that one, and I will see you guys next time. As always, thank you guys for taking the time out to listen. If you like my shit, subscribe to my shit or spinning. Bow, 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 bow. Backfist, baby. See you guys heading to the PI Center. Gotta get some work in. Peace.